Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. We're often told that you really can't fight City Hall. Well, our guest today has written a thought-provoking, common-sense article listing the problems of local governments on steroids and proposes adopting the 10 Rights of Local Liberty Charter, in which he says, and I quote, "Liberty is a normal condition for humans, without which the value of life is reduced." Nick Drenius is the Director for Constitutional Government at the Goldwater Institute in Arizona, and before that he was an attorney with the Institute of Justice. In addition to a new charter for American cities, 10 Rights to Restrain Government and Protect Freedom, which is the article we're going to be talking about today, Nick has authored several other articles. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's exciting to be on a radio show so far away.
So far away. Well, you hopefully will be heard around the world. You've heard about the Scott that was heard around the world, right?
Yes, I have. But we're just shooting with ideas here.
We're just shooting with ideas. Well, I liked your ideas. It's a long article, and what I'm going to do is put a link to the article on my website. So I would highly recommend that all of you go to the website and click on the link and get to the article and read it for yourselves. But until you do that, we're going to let Nick tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the basic idea of this report is to lay out the case for restructuring our cities, towns, and counties into models of freedom. And that's a phrase that Barry Goldwater used when confronted with a nation that was leaving its moorings in limited government principles in the 1960s. He said we needed to change our nation to be a model for freedom. We had to change our hearts and minds to embrace models of freedom. And I think we're in a similar position today. We've got local governments that are so far away, so far removed from the limited government ideal, that they are grooming people for the socialism that is looming at the federal and state levels. And the only way we're going to stop ultimately the transition of our country from one modeled on individual freedom and responsibility to one modeled on socialism is if we get control of the local governments that are down the street, that know where we live, that patrol our streets, that have us on camera most of the time, and change them into the image of the government that we expect to see at higher levels. And so the report lays out the 10 rights that would need to be implemented in policies at the local level to transform government into the vision that the founders had for the national government, one in which individual freedom is systematically protected, one in which fiscal responsibility is systematically preserved and maintained. And the goal is to maximize the efficiency of local government, but without forgetting that the thing that legitimizes any government, even local government, is its commitment to securing liberty.
Are you saying that the most legitimate function of a government is to protect the citizens?
Yes, but it's beyond protecting citizens. It's also to protect citizens from government. You can't have a well-structured entity that has a monopoly on force, or duopoly or triopoly, as it may be, on force in a given region, and just lolly-golly think it's going to do everything right. You need to make sure that that use of force is strapped down and controlled and limited to things that are legitimately needed to protect people in the free and peaceful activities of their daily lives. And that's it. And so what you want to do is you want to create a framework to guide government as to exactly how its coercive powers should or should not be used. And then from that platform, you also want to show local government how to be more efficient, how to be maximally efficient in discharging those necessary coercive functions. So the basic principles here is that the government's power of coercion should be limited to protecting the boundaries between individuals' freedom of action. The idea here is the what I call the right to a presumption of liberty, what I borrowed from Professor Randy Barnett, is the idea that we should be presumed by law to freely act peaceably, subject only to the like freedom of others. And the idea actually goes back to Herbert Spencer and his idea of equal freedom in social statics in the late 1800s, which was hugely influential in our country, notwithstanding later claims to the contrary. But the idea is that we should return to the principle that government is limited, that freedom is plenary, meaning expansive, and the presumption, and we should require any law that would restrict our freedom to be very seriously justified, and particularly at the local level. That any new law, any new regulation that restricts what is, by all appearances, peaceful action, the proponent of that law should have to jump a number of very high hurdles before that law could ever be enacted. And the policy that I advocate to protect the presumption of liberty is a meaningful version of sunrise and sunset review, which is used in states to some effect, but not much, because they don't make it very strong. But sunrise review means that the proponent of a new law or regulation or a new agency that regulates would have to prove the law is legitimate, and legitimate not just in the sense that they might be able to get away with passing it, but also legitimate in the sense that it targets a real and provable threat, that it will actually reduce that threat better than just leaving things alone or other less restrictive alternatives, and that the performance of this law can actually be measured and tested and performance benchmarked so that you can actually see if it bears out and actually achieves what it claims it can achieve. That sort of review should be the hurdle that prevents any law that can't jump it from ever becoming law. And then on the back end, there should be sunset review. Every law should automatically expire unless it's obviously the kind of law that is directly tied to protecting our freedoms, like criminal laws. But every law that is not obviously targeted to violent or fraudulent conduct should sunset. It should go away after a certain period of time unless the proponent of the law can justify it and show that it met its objectives and that there still aren't better ways of doing things. This concept, both the sunrise and sunset concepts, are things that are in law in most states, are close to most states in the country, and there's no reason why that local government shouldn't have a similar restriction on their regulatory ability, but with some more teeth, because we find that local governments are even more pernicious in their willingness to regulate. I mean, for example, local governments in Arizona regulate fortune tellers, they regulate circuses, they regulate magic performance artists. These kinds of regulations happen at the local level because they're unicameral. You don't have two legislative bodies. It's easier to regulate more things more quickly. They don't go out of session. And so the risk from ridiculous regulation and extremely intrusive or unjustifiable regulation is much greater at the local level than at the state level. And so we need to have particularly strong protections from illegitimate regulation at the local level, and that's what the right to a presumption of liberty would do. Now, in addition to that right, I argue for 9 other rights that serve as the sort of the backbone of the policies that would implement them, and these include the right to property, the right to separation of powers, the right to freedom from crime, the right to fiscal responsibility, the right to genuine local sovereignty, the right to accountability, the right to transparency, and the right to reconstitute government. And we can talk about each of those if you'd like in whatever order you prefer.
I would love to go through each of them and have you expand a little bit about them. I do want to say before we do that, however, that in your executive summary, you start off, and this is where you end your big paper on, but in the executive summary, you start off with how local governments have increased, and you talk a little bit about special districts, which are known by various different terms across the country. I think Florida has CDDs or community development districts. In Virginia, they're starting out down in the southern part of Virginia, and they're called community development authorities, and you're calling them special districts. I think they're special tax districts in some places, but it is another form of government. And has this form of government been adopted to just basically shunt off their responsibilities or maybe circumvent the constitutional restraints on them? Is that what the problem is?
Well, the answer is yes, but let me explain them even in more definite terms. What these are sort of like, if you think in corporate terms, you have the parent corporation and you have the subsidiary. And what municipal law, what local governments have done, is they've created the equivalent of spin-off subsidiary corporations for municipal government. And just as you see with corporations, the use of subsidiaries to avoid, you know, certain restrictions, for good or ill, you'll spin off a subsidiary to a different country with a lower tax rate to avoid one country's tax rate and so on. You find that municipalities are not spinning off these special districts for the heck of it. They're doing it for a reason, and there is academic study of this which indicates that the usual reason why municipalities will take a portion of their taxing authority and a portion of the services they offer, say healthcare, and put it into a healthcare special district is because they want to avoid limitations on their expenditure authority or limitations on their taxing authority. And when they shunt it off to this spin-off entity, they can get away with spending and taxing at the same level as before with less of the services, and so can this entity. And so what you find is that these special districts have exploded in number, especially as fiscal responsibility movements have picked up steam in the past 30 years, mm-hmm. things that produced like the Tabor movement, the tax and expenditure limitation concept of limiting the growth and such things to population inflation growth. But that concept has actually been applied in Arizona to local governments. And when it was, literally in the next 10 years, the number of special districts spun off tripled. So you have this since 1972, the number of local governments, including special districts, grew from, if you exclude school districts, and I'll explain why later, grew from about 67,000 to about 88,000 in 2007, and that's about a 20,000 unit increase, which is more than one per day. And almost all of that increase was special districts.
And this is in just 1 year?
This is across the United States.
Across the United States.
Since 1972 until 2007, based on census okay. figures, the number of special districts has increased about 20,000. And that's doubling across the nation, basically, in 30 years. Now, this is a phenomenon where all of the growth, the significant, the explosive growth of local government is occurring in special districts. And the other reason why municipalities may be using special districts, which is even more pernicious, is that they're hard to follow. They have overlapping jurisdictions. In other words, you can have a healthcare district, a stadium district, a jail district, an irrigation district, all of which are separate entities, separately elected, with separate taxing authorities, separate budgets. They can all be in the same area. They can be partially overlapping. If you ever saw a Venn diagram, it can look like that. It's very difficult for a given citizen to know which of these districts they're hearing about are really governing them or affecting them until they get the tax bill. And it's very hard to find out how to track them because their meetings are all on different dates than the cities and they're from each other. Their election dates are all usually different from the general election dates. So, unless you're not on the inside, you're rarely going to be going to those elections. So these are really designed to obscure local governmental activities, to make them more independent or distant from the electoral process. And to evade whatever limited restrictions the legislature or the constitutions of the different states may try to place on the spending or taxing activities of local governments like municipalities or counties. So they are really like the Enron model writ large. And in fact, I've often wondered whether the Enron attorneys study municipal finance before getting into that business.
Is there any oversight on any of these, or are they just out there doing whatever it is they want to do with no oversight, no adult supervision, none of that?
Well, I would suspect that depends on state to state. In Arizona, special districts are considered to be creatures of statute. In other words, even though the city creates it, it basically invokes a separate statewide law that, you know, by doing certain things, they can create it. And once it's created, now it is on the same hierarchy, the same level as the city itself. So for all intents and purposes, they're no more supervised or regulated by the city, except by culture or politics or who knows, you know, with backdoor things they have going on. But in a legal sense, they're a separate entity, and they're an entity unto themselves with no more supervision than a city would have, because it's a creature of statute, which is a statewide law. And now, of course, states have auditors. Some do, and Arizona does, and the auditors do try to hold governmental subdivisions to certain accounting standards, and then I think you have the CAFR standards and so on. So there is some minor oversight, but it's the fox guarding the hen house. It is the government overseeing itself, and usually highly technical bureaucratic types who are good at counting beans and not so much good at seeing the big picture of how all these interlocking pieces are actually spending gobs of money unsustainably and regulating crazily.
Back to your 10 rights, Nick. And then the second one is the right to use and enjoy property. You want to tell us a little bit more about that? You want to expand on that?
Yeah. The first thing to understand is we start with the presumption of liberty, because really this is the root substantive concept that grounds all other freedoms and rights. And the right to use and enjoy property is really an extension of the right to freedom of action applied to material things that support your life. And so the right to use and enjoy property is a right that just underscores that, you know, we are material beings that need to survive by using and enjoying material objects, including land and the things we create. And governments need to respect this as a fundamental aspect of protecting our lives and our well-being and our dignity. And the specific fixes that we target to local government deal with three areas. Local governments, and the reason why is local governments are the dominant governmental body dealing with property rights. Not the federal government, not the state government, but local governments, because their zoning boards determine the day-to-day in-and-out uses of all property in minute detail. They are truly the gatekeeper to the enjoyment of your property rights. And so you need to prevent that power from being abused, and you need to restructure it so that that gatekeeping authority is only used to prevent property uses that are genuinely threats to health, safety, and a legitimate sense of welfare, one tied to the enjoyment of property.
One we always hear about is you don't want a slaughterhouse in the middle of the neighborhood.
Exactly. In other words, the only proper role for government is to coordinate compatible and exclude incompatible uses. And the question is how to do that best. One method is centralized and bureaucratic. That's called zoning. Another method is to let it go by the common law, which will involve litigation. Now, both models have their pros and cons. I happen to prefer the common law model, but there are folks in our on our side of many issues who are principled who prefer the zoning model only because of the costs of litigations and the uncertainty of litigation and so forth. But regardless, whatever model you choose, there's a good way to run it and there's a bad way to run it. And the first principle of any local government needs to be to recognize that when you purchase property, merely purchasing the property should give you a protectable right to all of its lawful uses at that point in time and forever. Believe it or not, that is not the law in most states. In most states, you do not have a property right to all of the lawful uses of your property until you start using them. And as a result, you can have vacant land that is zoned one way and then rezoned completely differently with you having no right to complain.
Right.
And that stems from an old understanding of property rights that predates the Industrial Revolution, where you really didn't have a real relationship to tangible things until you started using them. But today, in a modern economy, think of all the planning and organizing and marshaling of resources and reliance that goes into a property at the point of purchase. I mean, you have created a real objective relationship 9 times out of 10 anytime you purchase property because of the planning involved and the reliance and the relationships and contracts you enter into when you buy it. You know, you've created, if you're going to build something there, you've probably got your architect lined up before you've purchased the property. You've got your accountants, you've got your attorneys, you've got your contingent contracts for, you know, subcontractors and so on. All that happens usually, you know, in planning long before you purchase the property. And then when you purchase it, it just sort of consummates the deal. And that is something that is completely lost in the law today, because it's still thinking of property rights the way that, you know, feudal lords and serfs thought about it, that you don't actually have a right till you start working the land itself. And that needs to change. We need to now recognize property rights at the point of purchase. Now, if that was done, you would see a number of disputes that arise in local government with land use owners go away. And I highlight one particular example in the report, that of Mike Goodman, who found himself caught in litigation over whether or not he had a property right to exercise his building permit, which was revoked, when he only put in a foundation and some framing. He ultimately won, but it cost him $100,000. He went through three levels of courts, and what part of his property he did build was destroyed by vandals and the elements. If it had just been clearly established and unequivocally established that he had a right to every lawful use of the property at the point of purchase, he wouldn't have been run through that. And he's not the only guy who faces this sort of thing.
We're talking to Nick Dranius, who's the Director for Constitutional Government at the Goldwater Institute. He is also the author of A New Charter for American Cities, 10 Rights to Restrain Government and Protect Freedom. And if you've just joined us, we're going through a list of 10 rights that he talks about, but you'll want to know about them. So stay tuned and stay with us. Nick, you were talking about rezoning at one point. What about people who actually, and this is what they do here in Virginia, in Fairfax County, I should say, where people own land or they've been, you know, inherited land that have been in their families for generations. And then all of a sudden, the county decides that they want it. It's a form of taking. So they rezone it. And then they start taxing them at the rezoning, not what they already have, but they might decide that a better use for your house would be if we had 600 condominiums on here, and therefore we're going to tax you based on the fact that there are 600 condominiums there. So it's fiscal warfare. They just price them right out of their homes to sell.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting example of the divergence. When it's convenient to government to treat the property as if you have the lawful right and protected right to use your land, they will. When it's not, they won't. In other words, you'll note that they'll zone you for commercial, but if it still is agricultural land, if they want to take that away and you haven't actually started using it commercially and you wanted to, you can't have standing in court to challenge that decision. On the other hand, they're more than happy to tax you on it while it sits there as crops. Now, to be fair, they don't deserve fairness.
But I was going to say, wait a minute.
But to be even-handed about it, obviously if we were to have a vested property right and all lawful uses at the point of purchase, there would be the risk that that sort of practice would be, you know, theoretically consistent. But, you know, that would only change the debate to one of which, how high should our taxes be? And I think that it's better to have that debate on such plain terms than to have a debate over taxes be, well, I wanted to zone this or I wanted to zone that. I mean, we should have a straight up or down, clear debate over the magnitude of property taxes, period, and we shouldn't let all these little sub-issues obscure that debate.
We're going to, because we're not going to have time to get through all of them, I want to run through, and the next one is separation of powers.
This is critical, and that's why it's third. Local government, but let me back up. James Madison, relying on the French philosopher Montesquieu, said that the very definition of tyranny is the consolidation of all powers of government, executive, legislative, and judicial, in one hand. The very definition of tyranny is that. And that is exactly how most local governments operate. The city council has the power to make the laws, it has the power to enforce the laws, and it has the power to adjudicate the laws, and very often the same laws at the same time. I mean, literally, you'll have a meeting where they pass a law, then they convene, they break apart, they come back, they reconvene, and they start enforcing that law or similar law, and then they reconvene, they come back, and now they're adjudicating a revocation of a permit that had been issued under that law. This is an absurd consolidation of power that can only be abused and inject politics into decision-making that should be based on the rule of law, not of men. And so what we need to do to fix this problem is make it very clear in the local governmental charter or home rule constitution or the statutes that create local governments, depending on how your state has things organized, whatever it is the fundamental law is that defines the powers of local government, that law should clearly define what is the executive power and what is the legislative power and what is the judicial power. And it should then say either you must create separate departments that are distinct, that are exercising these powers except as necessary to check the other powers, you know, just like the president can veto legislation. That doesn't make him exercising the legislative power. That's just a feature that allows him to check and balance the legislative power. But you should either divide up these powers in a way that's analogous to what you see at the state or federal level in formally distinct departments, or if you don't have the budget to do that, what you ought to do is you should give citizens the right to demand private mediation and arbitration of any decision that involves a combination of powers, which would otherwise be the very definition of tyranny. And the reason why I advocate private mediation is that it's private. And the way that private mediation or arbitration is structured is both sides have to agree to a mediator or an arbitrator. And that means it serves the same purpose the separation of powers would serve, which is to check and diffuse governmental power when it's combined in a way that tends to be abused. And the other nice thing about private mediation or arbitration is that it's inexpensive, it's not hyper-technical, and ordinary citizens could invoke this right without having to hire an attorney. At the same time, if cities have their own administrative review process, I think competition from this option would actually increase the fairness of that process. I mean, cities would probably prefer that you not go to a private mediator if they can run you through their own administrative process and collect fees. And given that people will choose binding arbitration if you've got kangaroo court administrative processes, they would be heavily incentivized to improve those administrative processes. So I see nothing but positive benefits of this sort of fix, and it's a crucial one.
There are many people who probably would not take that position, but one of the arguments I've heard against it is the fact that it is private, and so you have no precedent to fall back on. So if you take someone to court or you go to arbitration for something, that's a sealed document, unlike the courts, which will, for the most part, be open. Then I come along, I can't say, well, wait a minute, you know, Nick's already been through that process. Why do I have to go through it again? And so everybody would have to go through it one after the other and maybe not have the same outcome without establishing some clear benchmarks.
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that this would be a right the citizen would have the option of demanding, not the government. In other words, the government could not run you through any mediation or arbitration process. You would always have the default rights to do whatever else you might want to do. So I'm not concerned about that because citizens will have had the option to consider the alternatives and can choose this intelligently. And frankly, you know, you don't want to have precedentially driven hyper-technical, legalistic arbitrations and mediations. That would defeat the purpose of it. The whole point of it is to really make it a Judge Wapner-type experience, if that's what someone wants to do. And
but put the choice clearly in the hands of the citizens.
Absolutely.
Next is the right to freedom from crime. I like this one, Nick.
Well, you know, it strikes me as absurd, and it's always struck me as absurd. Even I was a trial lawyer one time in private practice, suing government agencies, including police departments, for lousy or even malicious police enforcement or failure to protect. And I, you know, would run up against these immunity doctrines. And basically, the core function of local government, providing a police service, was something they had no obligation to furnish. And that bothers me. I think that the reason why we have such terrible policing in this country is because the core function is something that they can't be held accountable for. So this right is meant not so much as a fundamental freedom type right. It's not something that is a natural right, obviously. It's a claim on government and how it should conduct itself. So it's a second order right. But it is something that I think local governments need to be structured around. They need to be structured on the idea that they have an account, they are accountable and required to furnish good policing. And the best way to do this is to simply require that governments, local governments, have objectives, have goals for policing. And not just, you know, a 10% reduction in crime, but an actual crime rate that they think is the desired crime rate that is reasonable and comparable and attainable. In other words, how are you going to ever achieve any goal if you don't have a goal? You can't just, if you're going to go throughout life and just say, I'm going to make it 10% better every month, it's not going to mean anything. You need to know what better is.
Yeah, and how you're going to get there, too.
Right, and so why don't, and you can, I mean, I've not discovered one yet, and I bet you there ain't one. But, you know, why is there not a city that says our desired murder rate within 1 year is X? Right? And then you can, of course, have other goals and benchmarks that are sub-goals or benchmarks related to that. You could have, you know, let's improve towards that goal 5% every month or whatever. But there has to be an ultimate goal. And so the fundamental fix here is let's make all policing goal-oriented. And then let's have consequences for failing to meet those very specific goals. And the consequence should be either the city opens up competitive bidding to all available localities or other police agencies for their business, or even private private security firms, and or they should give tax credits to citizens who furnish police services or security services that have side, you know, externality benefits. So, for example, if an HOA goes out because it's tired of the lousy policing in their HOA community, goes out and hires a security firm, they should get a property. They should get a property tax credit for that if the city is consistently failing to meet its goals.
But the reason you have the HOA is so the city doesn't have to pay for anything.
Well, and
that's counterintuitive.
And that would create a very healthy disincentive for cities to artificially demand the creation of HOAs, right? If they knew that by spinning these things up, that someday if they don't do their job, they're going to get, you know, stuck with a greater, they're going to get stuck with giving them a tax credit, that might disincentivize creating them where they're not naturally demanded.
Nick, before we go on, I interviewed Senator Mike Schneider not too long ago, and one of the bills that he was proposing was to ban the use of radar by private rent-a-cops, basically in HOAs, because with the rent-a-cops, they're not required to protect your constitutional rights. So once you get behind these gates, they can pretty much do whatever they want. And he said that there's no appeal. If somebody decides that, well, the HOA is running out of money and we need to fine you for doing something, so we use the radar gun, we claim that you were going 26 in a 25-mile zone, there's no appellate process there. You're stuck with it. So if you go and get if you start using private cops to do what the public cops are doing, do you foresee making them protect constitutional rights? I mean,
well, keep in mind that if we're talking about the city spinning out or spinning off or bidding out its own services, then whoever gets the contract is the city's agent. So as a matter of ordinary contract, I mean commercial and contract law, that entity, whether it's private or anything else, would be bound by the same responsibilities the city has. The city cannot avoid its constitutional restrictions by contracting
It's being done. I can tell you right now it's being done, but not in HOAs. I mean, where you have cities, for instance, Silver Spring leases part downtown Silver Spring to a private organization, and you know the Constitution just doesn't apply anymore. It's a private organization that owns the city streets.
Well, the way I would argue that case is to say that that's mistaken. When the government, I mean, and frankly, I'm surprised that a lot of these principles were well established during the Civil Rights era. Because when the southern states finally got beat up so many times for racism in their various governmental functions, the first thing they started to do in the 70s was spin off private contracts to, say, people to run their parks and not let any blacks in. Mm-hmm. And then they try to argue behind that contract mm-hmm. that, hey, it's not us, it's that guy that we hired, and gosh, look at that, they're just doing terrible things. The Supreme Court saw right through that. But the bottom line is if this is an inherent function of government, like policing is, and they choose to contract it out to anybody,
okay,
that person would ordinarily be governed by constitutional law. Now, if it's not an inherent function of government, if it's government running a business, then constitutional law gets a little screwy. And frankly, I don't know what the right answer is, without looking at specific facts.
Okay, we're talking to Nick Dranius, who's the director for constitutional government at the Goldwater Institute in Arizona, and we're talking about an article he wrote, "A New Charter for American Cities: 10 Rights to Restrain Government and Protect Freedoms." And I think we're now at number 5, the right to fiscally responsible government. What a concept, Nick.
Well, yeah, and I think
what a concept.
The biggest fix that probably is not politically feasible in most places, but it should be tried, is simply to restrict the fundamental law of a local government, restrict it to core functions, restrict it to governmental functions. Don't let cities run golf courses, don't let cities run theaters, don't let cities run hotels or convention centers. Restrict local government to what government does best, or I should say relatively best. And that would be a very quick fix to avoid a lot of problems with budgeting issues later on. Now, short of that, if you're going to have government do stuff that is not core or even is core, then you should contract everything out. There's no reason now, with the kind of transparency that's available to us with modern technology, where you can really keep an eye on everything the government's contracting and keep open bidding truly transparent to the public, there's no reason why the government shouldn't just outsource everything. And it should do it in a competitive process that's been used in Indianapolis, in South Carolina, in Charlotte, in San Diego, in Phoenix. It's called managed competition. And what's great about it is it's not pure privatization, not necessarily. What you do is you say, I have got service X. I want anyone performing the service to hit these goals. I'll let everyone who can perform the service bid on it, including the department that's currently doing it. And if the department that's currently doing it can win the bid, then they get it, and they stay in business. If they can't, they don't. And the interesting thing about this is it bypasses the union argument, the public employee union argument, that you're frittering away existing infrastructure and know-how by privatizing, because you're saying to them, no, you guys can compete. You just got to win the bid. And they can't complain that it's not fair to compete because they don't pay taxes, so they have a 25% cost advantage. And the funny thing is, almost 90% of the time when this is done, private companies still get the bid. This is a great logjam breaker, because you can diffuse any union argument that's thrown up against privatization by saying, all right, well, we'll give you a leg up, and you can compete, and now what's your problem?
So this would be the actual government employees who are unionized who would be competing to do the jobs that they were hired to do?
Exactly. And you would keep the competition, you know, as broad as possible. You would invite anybody, neighboring companies, neighboring cities, neighboring, you know, overlapping counties, crazily designed special districts, whoever, the state, other states, it doesn't matter. Invite anybody and everyone from any kind of entity to come and compete for this service. And it works. It saves huge amounts of money.
What types of things are we looking at? Trash removal, snow removal,
everything.
Street lighting, everything?
Everything. There's no reason, there is no function of government that the private sector doesn't provide a competitive potential bid. I mean, you name a service, there is a private company out there performing it somewhere, somehow. And as a practical matter, the test for a local government committed to this should be that if there are 3 people in the Yellow Pages that perform the same function, offer this service, then you should definitely outsource it, or at least make it capable of outsourcing.
Interesting concept. I wonder how it would work.
It's worked great in Indianapolis.
Really?
In the 90s, Mayor Goldsmith outsourced probably about 40 or 50% of the city services, pretty much everything other than safety and fire and police. And they saved over 10 years something like $450 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. So the cities wouldn't have to go bankrupt and go begging for stimulus money, huh?
Well, they'd probably do it anyway.
They'd do it anyway. All right, the sixth right. I'm keeping an eye on the clock here. I just want to make sure we get through them all. The sixth right is the right to freedom from favoritism.
This is the local government is where, you know, the cliques are. It's where the connected people are in a really big way. And it's where the discrimination against the unpopular or the minority or just not the powerful really happens. And so we need to really make it clear what we're talking about. We're not just talking about anti-discrimination here. We're not just talking about unequal treatment here. We're talking about blowing away the whole concept of favoritism in government. We should be seen as individuals of equal legal worth in the eyes of government for everything. And I think the main thing to target here that has eluded all the anti-discrimination and equality under the law concepts that we already have is subsidies. Somehow, you know, the favoring of particular people for any benefits that are not generally dispersed has been going on immensely in local government. I mean, I just did a research project and came across in 2.5 hours 8 projects that totaled almost $1 billion in subsidies.
Wow.
All of which have failed across the country from the East Coast to the West Coast. And 2 hours of research, that's what I found. We've got to stop subsidies. And the problem is, the reason why they haven't been stopped is that any prior attempts to stop them have always been crafted to preserve a loophole for this or that or that, you know, favored kind of thing, or they use very complicated language and they just don't ban subsidies outright. What local governments need to do is recognize that history shows that if you don't just completely ban subsidies, there will inevitably be a loophole in interpretation that will allow subsidies to go on by another name. So what I propose is just, you know, it's nothing fancy, nothing unusual, you know, nothing hard to explain. Just literally have an absolute clear ban on subsidies. There's no justification for subsidies, ever.
Cousin Luigi, get a real job, right?
Yeah.
All right. The next one is accountability.
Well, this is the right to accountability is just based on the recognition that we live increasingly in an administrative state run by bureaucrats who are not elected and who are protected by civil service rules that make them almost impossible to fire. Even if they're not unionized, these rules protect them and make them so hard to fire. And then on top of that, you have constitutional law that says you can't engage in patronage, hiring, and firing for political reasons. So even if you hire, if you vote a guy in whose job is to fire this horrible bureaucrat who's made that part of his campaign promise, he can't do it. It's unconstitutional. So the fix for this is to, again, take the organic law of local government and just have what I suggest is a 3-strikes-and-you're-out rule. Literally have a law that says if you misinterpret or misapply the law in a way that causes harm, you know, substantial harm or detriment to a citizen, 3 times, you lose your job. No analysis of neglect, no analysis of your political persuasion, keep it completely neutral, and just put it at the same level in the law as the civil service rules themselves, and get rid of these folks.
So right now, presumably, you could have someone who causes irreparable harm over and over and over again, and they cannot be fired.
That's correct. And in the example I give in the book is again the story of that gentleman, Mike Goodman. It turns out that the zoning administrator had been immediately. This is the gentleman who was denied the right to build his property
in the city of Tucson.
Well, when he bought the property, he met with the zoning administrator and told him exactly what he was going to do with it, and it was the city's property, and he was told, given all the green lights. And this gentleman probably has done this on multiple occasions to multiple people, and he's still the zoning administrator. It's no skin off his nose that the city ultimately lost the legal battle. He's got his job. And he's not alone. We have another story of a person who owns a bed and breakfast in a rural county near Sedona. They were told to apply by the same person for the wrong license 3 times, and wouldn't get refunded their money. And they wasted months and hours of their time going through this regulatory process. Well, there's no consequence to the bureaucrat that kept shunting them around and disrupting their business plans at all. So we need to, and this is a common phenomenon. Now, people have complained that maybe it should be 1 strike. I think that's unreasonable because people do make mistakes, and we have to allow for Also, just problems of knowledge. Sometimes, you've got he said, she said situations. But if you've got three occasions like this, I think you have a fair pattern, and I think that's enough. And I think that in a we should hold people to their decision making if it's a repetitive phenomena. Even if you can't point to wrongful or malicious reasons for it, if the product that this bureaucrat is producing is wrong interpretations of law that cause people injury in three occasions or more, they should go away.
Again, what a concept. I mean, I've seen so many incompetent people just hang around and around and just keep doing what they've always been doing. So I like that as well. We're going on to the next one, genuine local sovereignty.
Well, this gets back to your part about the stimulus. Local governments can actually be agents for positive change. They can actually enforce the requirements of our liberty, one of which is federalism, creating a division between the government of the state and the government of the federal government. Local governments are subdivisions of the state. There's no reason why they can't enforce the federalism entitlements that states have, that of being a distinct sovereign entity. And one way they can do that is by just saying no to stimulus funds all the time, because they are never string-free. They always have strings. And the strings usually are to require the city to provide services that are not sustainable absent the funding from the federal government, and that create dependent constituencies so that it becomes impossible to ever redirect the portion of the local funding they apply to that, to anything else. If they want to maintain their independence from the federal government and preserve our liberty from being dominated by centralized federal policies, they just have to say no to federal stimulus money. And because it's a hard decision, because you feel like a chump, because it is partly your money now that's going to go somewhere else, that hard decision needs to be part of the fundamental law of local government. Now, in addition to that, local governments should always demand that federal agencies coordinate their new policies with them. Now, this doctrine actually means, and it's in their court-ordered decisions to this effect, that with most federal laws, there's a provision that says that if a local body demands that you coordinate a new law, so say you have a spot-at-all law that they want to enforce in your county, that all you have to do is petition formally with the federal agency enforcing that law and demand that they coordinate that new law with your existing local policy. So if you had a freedom-oriented land use policy, you could say, we don't recognize under our policy, constraining all lawful uses of property because there might be a spot at all on it. And you have to sit down with us and coordinate your new policy with ours. And the law says that they have to meet as equals and that nothing can be done to enforce the federal law until a mutual decision is made. You can imagine how many federal laws that are implemented could be blocked or modified in freedom-friendly ways if this simple right, which exists in almost every federal law, were exercised systematically. So that's something that should be part of the fundamental law of local government. Everything from the Endangered Species Act to the Clean Water Act, even Homeland Right. Security could be blocked or reshaped in this way.
We've got two more to get through, and number nine is transparency.
Well, that speaks for itself. If you're going to do all this outsourcing and bidding and competitive outsourcing and contracting, then the greatest concern is corruption. And we need, therefore, to have strong transparency measures if we're going to have serious outsourcing. And that means real-time finances online that citizens can download or take a look at that are presented in comprehensible ways.
Right.
And it also means we should have immediate access to all the negotiations and contracting discussions that happen as they happen. And there's a few other things, but we're running close on time, so.
We are, and we've got one more, and it's one of the ones I want to get to. And that's number 10, reconstitute local government. Take it away, Nick.
All right, well, this last right is really the fail-safe button. If all else fails and you're still left with a government, a local government that is just out of control and unwilling to reform and unable to be reformed because it's just dominated by bad people committed to bad policies, and the local system won't change it, doesn't allow an opportunity to change, now you've got to have a right to reconstitute government, sort of the local governmental version of the Second Amendment, right? When all else fails in the federal government, there's a fail-safe provided by the Second Amendment. At least the founders thought so.
That's debatable in today's environment, but yeah, go on.
But there needs to, the concept is valid.
Yeah,
it recognizes that governments can become, by all normal measures, just unrepairable.
Right.
So this concept is we should have a binding none of the above vote. We should have the ability to dissolve special districts that are not accountable electorally. And we should also be able to force our cities into bankruptcy when they're insolvent and not let them jazz us around with delay and obfuscation of their books. And if you have these three fixes, you would be able to reconstitute basically any local government that is systematically committed to running badly. With the right to vote for none of the above, if you've got a political clique or class that is basically offering up these connected people who run for office or shift offices all the time, and nobody really likes them or knows where they're coming from and doesn't really want them, well, if they keep offering up, if this is what the establishment keeps offering up, well, you keep voting for none of the above. And what I argue is that so long as none of the above gets a majority of the vote or more than any other person, you should force them to keep having elections until such time as you get somebody who is getting more votes than none of the above.
We've got just a second. Can we explain exactly what you mean by, I know what you mean by none of the above, but let's make sure that the listeners understand that concept.
The state of Nevada, on its statewide ballots, has a slot that is labeled none of the above, that you can vote for any office. And the thing about it is that there's no consequence to it. You could vote for it as like writing, it has the same effect as writing in Mickey Mouse. And what I'm saying is, no, there should be a consequence to that. And the consequence should be that if none of the above keeps generating more votes than any other live person, or more than 50%, then there should not be a winner of that election who is a live person. It should be none of the above. And that the election should be required to be rescheduled, and they should have a special election. And after a certain number of these elections, if people keep voting in none of the above, the government, the local body that is unable to yield up good candidates should go away. Because these are subdivisions of the state. They don't need to exist. They can be subsumed back into whatever superior entity exists. And if you have, a city that will not offer up anybody that anybody wants to vote for, there's no reason why it shouldn't become unincorporated again.
Sounds like a plan. Nick, can you give us a website address so that people can check you out? I will have a link on my website, but
it is www.goldwaterinstitute.org.
And what can the ordinary citizens do to help get some of these things implemented?
Print up the report, distribute it, educate everyone about the idea, the radical idea, it seems, that local governments need to be seen through the same lens of principles of limited government as every other government, and demand no less from your local public officials than that they adhere to the vision of the Founding Fathers. Now, practically beyond that, the other thing you need to do is explore what citizens' initiative options you have at the local level in your state. If you can actually, through citizens' initiative, change the charter or the home rule constitution of a city to include a Bill of Rights modeled on the local liberty charter ideas that I advance, that is the real fix.
Nick, thank you so very much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you'll come back sometime.
Well, I hope I write something worthy.
Well, I think you will. So we'll just keep in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.